call the next case.
May it please the court, my name is Hugh Antrim. I'm with the Richmond law firm of Thompson and McMullen. This is my colleague, Michael Matheson, seated at council table. I'd like to reserve 2 or 3 minutes for a brief rebuttal, if I may.
How much?
2 or 3 minutes.
Okay.
We represent Donna Pettit and Christopher Pettit, two of the three children of the decedent Harvey Pettit. The third child is the defendant, Ronald Pettit, who in his capacity as executor under his father's last will and testament. Ronald Pettit served as his father's attorney in fact during his father's last years, and my clients believe that Ronald Pettit breached his fiduciary duty to his father as attorney in fact during his father's lifetime. However, any such claim post mortem belonged to the estate of Harvey Pettit, and Ronald Pettit, the executor, has a duty to investigate any claims the estate may have against Ronald Pettit, attorney in fact. We filed the subject complaint in the Circuit Court of Stafford County asking the court to remove Ronald Pettit as executor because he had somewhat of a conflict of interest and he was not going to investigate claims against himself and sue himself. Counsel for Ronald Pettit filed a plea in bar to the statute of limitations citing section 801-248 of the Code of Virginia. That section certainly is appropriate where a case of breach of fiduciary duty, a tort, but that's not what was on the table in Stafford. Our clients had no standing to pursue any claim against Ronald Pettit, attorney in fact. Only the executor had that standing. So we sought the removal of Ronald Pettit and the appointment of an independent successor fiduciary. At any rate, the trial court, by letter opinion, opined in section 801-248 was applicable and sustained the plea in bar. I filed a motion to reconsider because I don't believe that the removal of the fiduciary who has been qualified by the circuit court to serve as a fiduciary is tied to any statute of limitations. Fiduciaries serve at the pleasure of the court, and any removal of a fiduciary is at the pleasure of the court as well. And that removal sounds in equity. The trial court declined my request for a hearing on my motion to reconsider. I'm aware of the Brandon Cox decision, although quite frankly I'm not sure of its current posture, but I differentiate that case to my motion to reconsider because I didn't file it and bury it in the clerk's office. I filed it and sent a direct copy of it to Chambers, as well as the clerk's office, along with the order, and the order sustaining the clean bar, I objected to for the reasons stated in my motion to reconsider.
So, Counsel, does the record indicate that you sent a separate copy to Chambers?
Yes, sir.
So could you
page
point
70
out
of the appendix? To the clerk, I enclose an order properly endorsed, which I ask to present to the court for entry. I also enclose my motion for reconsideration by copy of this letter and said motion directly to Judge Bass's chambers. I'm asking for a 15-minute hearing before the order becomes final.
Thank you.
So I reached a speedy conclusion that the trial court committed error in applying 801-248 as a statute of limitations applicable to the removal of the fiduciary, the allegation being the fiduciary was conflicted and should be removed. Thank you.
Counsel, let me ask a question,
ma'am,
before you sit down.
Certainly.
The motion that you sent raises the issue of latches. The trial court interpreted that to be a wholly new issue being raised, and quite frankly, when I look at the argument that took place before the trial court, it appears to me that the trial court may be correct that latches is raised for the first time in that motion to reconsider. So would that be a variant on Brandon v. Cox where you raise an entirely new issue in a motion to reconsider, which the court never rules on, you never receive a ruling on it? First question. second question, would it be more akin to approbate and reprobate and the issue be barred?
Justice Powell, I merely was pointing out a motion to reconsider that the court told me that there was a statute of limitations applicable to removal of fiduciary, and I was saying no such thing. I suppose I volunteered that because the removal of a fiduciary sounds in equity, were there going to be a time issue related, it would be latches. But certainly, as the plaintiff, I'm not going to suggest that I'm time barred by latches. I just was pointing out to the court that this is equity. This is not a tort. This is not.
Let me rephrase my question. It seems to me that the argument before the court was, what is the appropriate statute of limitations? And then in the motion to reconsider, for the first time the issue comes up, there is no applicable statute of limitations. The real consideration is latches.
Well, I don't know about the real consideration being latches. What happened was the matter was briefed, and quite frankly, the trial court, after we argued, said he hadn't read the briefs yet, and so he would take the matter under advisement. And his letter opinion somewhat came to the blue. So in my motion to reconsider, it had never occurred to me that the statute of limitations we were talking about had anything to do with the removal of the executor. It had more to do with whether or not it made any difference whether to remove the executor, because any claim a successor fiduciary would have against the attorney in fact would be time barred. It was a huge disconnect. And so the motion, when I realized that Judge Bass ruled that 248 applied to the removal of the fiduciary, no. Judge, let me argue with that. The only way I could do that was
what
motion
was the argument? What was the subject of the argument of the hearing before Judge Bass? Because if I perhaps missed it as well. I thought it was that a statute of limitations applied.
Well, I can't speak for the defendant, counsel, but I was very clear from the beginning that, yes, 248 applied to a breach of fiduciary duty, but that my clients, because they didn't have any claim yet, they had no standing, only the estate had standing to bring that we would have to proceed with a new fiduciary, and then if there was a problem with the statute of limitations, it would be addressed in the hands of a new fiduciary.
Your complaint is a complaint to remove executor.
Yes, ma'am.
And their argument was that the complaint is barred by the statute of limitations.
Yes, ma'am.
And
for which there is no statute.
Sir?
For which I believe there is no such statute.
And your statement during that hearing is the real deal is the statute of limitations. And that statute's been told first because of the incapacity. And so it seems to me that the argument before the court was that this whole issue is governed by a statute of limitations, not latches.
I can foresee a court telling me I'm not going to remove the executor, because if I did, and the independent fiduciary had these claims that you say are against the attorney in fact, they are time barred under 248.
Isn't that exactly what the court ruled?
No, I think the court ruled that there's a two-year statute of limitations on the removal of an executor, because that was the complaint.
As I look at the ruling of the circuit court, it almost seems like to me the circuit court was saying, you are asking us to remove this executor because he has a conflict of interest. And we're going to look to see whether or not that alleged conflict of interest is barred by statute of limitations. You're saying it's not because it was told, et cetera, et cetera. They're saying that it was. And the court rules on the statute of limitations really concerning the breach of fiduciary duty, which is the substance and the essence of why you think this executor ought to be removed.
If I follow that correctly, I respectfully disagree, because there is no statute of limitations for the removal of an executor.
I understand that. But if your only reason for removing him is because of a breach of fiduciary duty that no one can pursue, then the question is whether or not you've alleged any conflict at all if the court rules that the conflict that you claim exists does not exist at law. And I thought that's what the whole argument was about. And I thought that's the whole reason why you all were debating whether or not the statute of limitations was told, because as you said, the question was, could anyone pursue the breach of fiduciary duty against the son who was the executor?
I thought so too, until I read Judge Bass's letter opinion, which doesn't say that.
I think it's ambiguous.
I don't think he could have sustained, well...
Remember, you want a special plea.
I don't think there's any way to reasonably read Judge Bass's letter opinion and come away with a suggestion that he did not rule that there's a two-year statute of limitations on the removal of an executor, not on whether or not, once removed, you couldn't go anywhere with it anyway.
Well, you've got a few minutes. You might want to take a look at it.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, I've got a question. Let's step out of the courtroom and into the classroom. Without asking you to concede whether you could have argued latches in front of Judge Bass before he issued his other opinion, or whether you should have or whether you did, but just as a matter of law, if an attorney doesn't make an argument prior to receiving a ruling, does not mention latches prior to receiving a ruling, and then subsequently files a motion for reconsideration that for the first time does mention latches, can it then properly be before this court?
Under our circumstances, I believe so, Justice Mims, because I did not have an opportunity to engage the trial court on its decision, because the trial court basically said, I haven't had a chance to read your briefs, so I'm not entirely sure I followed what you told me. I'll take it under advisement. Now, contrary to that, if he'd said from the bench, this is what I'm thinking, this is what I'm going to rule, I could have said, wait a minute, Judge, let's talk about this, because I don't understand what you're telling me. Are you telling me in equity that the 2-year statute of limitation? We got it straight. I had no alternative but to file a motion to reconsider. And again, I'll read the trial court's letter ruling, but to me it's pretty clear that the sustaining of the plea and bar had to do with a statute of limitations applicable to my complaint, the removal of a fiduciary.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Lori Lord with McGuire Woods. I'm here today on behalf of the defendant, in this case, Ronald A. Pettit.
Counsel, let me just right away pose the same question to you. Again, in the classroom, if a party does not make an argument, receives a ruling, and then subsequently makes that argument on a motion to reconsider, is that person legally precluded from bringing that argument to the appellate court?
Particularly in this case, yes, Your Honor, because the only assignment of error is as to the new issue. The only assignment of error is as to latches. And
so if there were multiple assignments of error, we could legally take it, but if there's only one assignment of error, we legally can't?
No, Your Honor. There is no error preserved in this case. As you correctly described, the term latches was not mentioned until the motion to reconsider.
But is that relevant in terms of whether we can now make a decision on it?
Absolutely. The plaintiff should have brought that argument in the alternative during the plea and bar proceedings. I submit there is no misunderstanding here. The plaintiffs argued in their brief to the trial court that the focus of our inquiry is whether the statute of limitations has been told. They said in the trial court in the hearing, standing in front of him, that the statute of limitations is the real deal. The court replied back, the primary issue in this case is the statute of limitations, and plaintiff's counsel didn't correct him in any way.
Let me ask one more time, and actually I would like for other counsel to hear it also, because I'd like to have a response during his remaining time. Each of you has answered a question that was in the in the academic sense, although very important to me, by coming right back to this case immediately. And my question is, as a matter of law, if something is not raised prior to a ruling and then is clearly and squarely raised on reconsideration, can this court make a decision on the merits of that issue? And so if either of you have some law that you would like to argue, independent of this case, I'd be grateful to hear it.
When there has not been a hearing on that motion to reconsider, and when there's been no ruling on that motion to reconsider, Brandon instructs us that no error has been preserved, and this court may not hear that new argument.
As you may have guessed, I don't read Brandon quite that broadly. I might be the only one, but other outside of the Brandon issue, where in terms of whether it was heard or not, can it be? Can we consider it?
This court has said it is that, first of all, a court can't reconsider what is never considered in the first place, which is what happened here. This is a quote from Downing versus Houston. It is better these defenses should be lost by the negligent litigant than that the vitally important rule that there must be an end to litigation be set aside. It is also fundamentally unfair to fault a trial court for failing to rule correctly on an issue it was never given the opportunity to consider.
But it was given the opportunity to consider this here. It's clear from the record, at least to me, that the trial judge knew that a motion to reconsider had been filed. Now, I don't know whether the trial judge ever looked at it, but it apparently went to his chambers, unless it got lost in the mail, and it was noted as an objection on the final order that we do know the trial judge signed. So he had an opportunity to rule.
But under Brandon versus Cox, the litigant, the movement, has to do more than pop it in the mail.
Cox, the litigant couldn't show that the judge ever even knew about the filing of the motion, the existence of the motion to reconsider. And we do know here that there's evidence in the record that the judge should have known about the existence of it.
Well, and the judge's letter back to counsel acknowledged that his office had received it, but he was on break during the phone call that apparently led to the ruling outside the 21-day denying the motion to rehear. Plaintiff's counsel did not even bother sending in an order to grant or deny the motion. But in Brandon versus Cox, we weren't sure what the argument was in the trial court in the first place. I think the record was absent on that. Here we know it was an absolutely contradictory argument that was made below. And you can't argue that. You can't concede that the statute of limitations governs your claims and then argue the opposite in a motion to reconsider. Never bring that on for hearing or even a ruling, and then allow that to be your primary argument on appeal. If that were the rule, it would open the floodgates to piecemeal appeals in this court. If this court orders the trial court to consider latches, the court's going to rule against one of the parties, and we're going to be right back up here again. I think it's a perfect example of a piecemeal appeal. You know, under finality, the plaintiff's counsel should have had the final order suspended when he wasn't getting a response from the court that he wanted. People file injunctions, they knock on the door, they get it done to make sure that they have their record they need before this court, and plaintiff's counsel did none of that. This is really... These plaintiffs' fourth bite at the apple. They have sued my client 3 times. And now they're bringing up a brand new issue to try before you for the first time. And even if the latches argument is preserved, which I wholeheartedly feel that it is not, it's not correct. This court ruled in Kappa Sigma in 2003 that a claim in equity brought on fiduciary duty claims is determined by the applicable statute of limitations. When there's a statute of limitations to apply, you apply it. And Kappa Sigma was a case about whether a corporate act was ultra vires, and this court ruled based upon underlying conduct that that was allegedly breached fiduciary duties to the corporation. And this court ruled that the catch-all statute of limitations, the same one as at issue here, governs a claim in equity for breach of fiduciary duty. And that is exactly what we have here. You determine whether statute of limitations applies by the object of the litigation, the substance of the complaint.
And the substance here is to remove a fiduciary.
Yes, but it's if you look at the allegations of the complaint, they say that Ronald Pettit is unable to fully perform his fiduciary duty, and that's why they want him removed.
But it's not, there doesn't have to be a finding that he actually violated his fiduciary duties in order to conclude, yeah, we probably need to remove this person.
Correct, but the court does need a cause to remove an executor, particularly one who has been appointed by the testator. And
well, suppose the complaint was the fiduciary needs to be removed because he or she is either physically or mentally not able to do it anymore. They're just not capable. They're sick. That's not a breach of fiduciary duty necessarily. So what's the statute of limitations? We're going to have different statute of limitations depending upon what the reason is for removal?
I believe so, yes. I think that's what 64.2-14-1410 says, that when from a proper to proper, the court may remove the fiduciary. And in any event, that's not this case. In this case, we have an executor who managed his father's business affairs for 13 years before he died, has been administering the estate for the past 5 years. The estate is substantially administered. I think Your Honor was absolutely correct in the trial court's ruling. Why would he remove this person when there are no viable claims to bring, for his successor to bring? And in addition, he's seen these parties over the years, and over 5 years now. He knows that the estate is substantially administered. Even if he were removed, there's nothing left to be done in the estate, practically, other than to close it.
Well, that may be a reason not to remove him. But does that mean, because the court didn't say, I'm not going to remove him. He just said, the plea and bar is good. This case was brought beyond the statute of limitations, period. So he dismissed it for that reason, not because he shouldn't be removed.
Well, again, I submit that the trial court properly had in mind that if he did remove Mr. Pettit in a month or two, that case was going to be on his docket again, and he was going to have to make the same ruling again, that there are no claims for the successor to bring. In that second last paragraph of his order, the conduct complained of the same in all three proceedings initiated by the plaintiffs.
But the order says, upon consideration of, the court sustains the plaintiff's plea and bar parens statute of limitations. So he's saying this complaint to remove the fiduciary is barred by a statute of limitations. The court never decided, at least in its order, that I don't think there are grounds for removal.
Well, that's because he was never asked to, Your Honor.
I know. He just had a plea and bar in front of him.
The court had a concession, an agreement. Everyone agreed which statute of limitations applied. Everyone agreed.
Oh, I realize that, but I just don't think you can say that the court didn't remove him because he knew that the ultimate claim might be barred, because all the court did was sustain a plea and bar.
Well, I'm agreeing with Your Honor that is the court's reasoning is not a model of clarity, but that is certainly a practical consideration that he properly, managing his docket, can say, these claims are time barred, there are no claims for the successor to bring, and he was correct. These other arguments that plaintiff is making now were not presented to
him. He might have been correct in dismissing the case, but he wasn't correct, potentially, at least that's the argument, in sustaining a plea and bar.
But I think the argument, counsel, you might want to make is probably encapsulated best on page 42 in your motion in support of the plea and bar. At the top of that page, you say, because all of the plaintiff's claims are time barred, the complaint should be dismissed in its entirety. So the whole subject of the special plea was to prove the rationale asserted by the plaintiff for removing the executor was not a proper reason, and therefore the court could not grant them the relief they wanted, and by special plea could rule on it as opposed to having a trial.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And one of Your Honors made the good point, too, right? Without a viable claim that could be brought, there is no conflict.
Right. In essence, the whole reason for their assertion of there being a conflict and a good cause to remove the executor was obviated by showing that what they claimed was a conflict was not really a conflict. It would be almost as if, in that particular instance, they say, you know, Bernard Goodwin cannot be the executor of his mother's estate because there was an automobile accident in 1974 where his mom hit him, and he might be bringing a lawsuit against her concerning that, and therefore there's a conflict because he might be suing the estate. You file a special plea saying, look, that lawsuit you're talking about is barred by the statute of limitations. Therefore, there's no reason to remove him. Do you have another one? If that's your only reason, then the court might as well go ahead and decide that the relief cannot be granted. I think that's what you were trying to do.
Absolutely. That is what happened here. There's no question that's what happened here.
And it seemed like everybody understood that at the hearing.
I agree. The plaintiffs conceded two or three times about what was going on here. They never corrected the court, articulating back to them, either orally or in his letter opinion. They never objected to the finding that the statute of limitations has expired, that the statute of limitations is the issue here, and they certainly did not appeal that ruling.
And let me, one other thing. It seems like to me it was never a question of the statute of limitations of can the court remove an executor. The question was whether or not the underlying claim was barred by the statute of limitations.
Well, I don't even know that distinction was made in the trial court, but that is, everyone understood that. Again, this is the third time these parties have been before this court. The plaintiffs had a claim in 2009. They non-suited it. They didn't refile in time. That's what this case is about at bottom as well. We ask the court to affirm the trial court and to dismiss the appeal for failure to preserve error on the issue of latches. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A suggestion has been made that I agreed that the applicable statute of limitations was 248. I did not. I agreed that the applicable statute of limitations for breach of fiduciary duty was 248. With regard to, Justice Mims, with regard to your question, I would have thought, I think the case is Marjano, but I would have thought that a motion to reconsider the court's opinion on any basis could be challenged by a motion for reconsideration, because otherwise, how do you disagree with the court's analysis? So that would be my classroom answer. Now, let me focus on, for a moment, on the court's letter opinion, because the analysis the court went through was whether or not it was tied to, I'll just read the last paragraph.
Why don't you start on the last paragraph on page 67?
Could I start with the last couple lines on page 66? Where it says, the central issue, that is, this case time-barred?
Okay, that's fine.
And I underlined that in red.
And then pick up what the court says at the bottom of 67.
Yes, sir. Plaintiffs urged the court to find that if the defendant would remove the successor fiduciary, the seat of would not be time barred. That is exactly my position. That was my position.
Right. And then the court ruled against you on that.
Then he went on to talk about that in the last full paragraph of 68, the instant case was not refiled within 6 months of the non-suit of the first action to remove the executor. That's what he was basing his decision on.
But I thought it was his decision concerning whether or not the statute of limitations had run on your breach of fiduciary duty allegation.
Then he certainly should have granted my motion for reconsideration. We could have hashed it out, because that's not what he ruled in that letter opinion.
Well, counsel, what does the first paragraph on that page mean to you?
Page 68.
Yes.
Plaintiffs agree the applicable statute of limitations is 2 years pursuant to Section 801-248. But they argue any claim against the agent or donee of the power of attorney belonged to Mr. Pettit during his lifetime thereafter the person representative.
The whole discussion was about the statute of limitations for the breach of fiduciary duty claim, it seems like to me. Isn't it?
I don't think that was what the final order indicated, and I don't believe that's what the didn't anticipate the court's position on that, because I thought it was very clear what Judge Bass had ruled.
Well, let me ask you this. What did you think would happen if the court ruled that the claim that you assert could not be asserted by this executor, nor could it ever be asserted by any other executor if I replaced this one? What did you think? Because that's what you guys were trying to decide. That's what you were arguing to the judge. He rules against you and says, you're right. This whole thing about, you know, the son and his dealings with his dad is barred by the statute of limitations. The dealings with his dad before his dad passed away is barred by the statute of limitations. That's what he ruled. And so where do you go from here?
If that's how he ruled, I would agree with Your Honor 100%. And I mean no disrespect to the Circuit Court of Stafford County, but they couldn't have gotten it more muddled than that letter opinion, if that's what he meant to say. And I challenged him on the motion to reconsider and said, the way I read this, you're telling me there's a statute of limitations to remove an executor. I don't believe there's a statute, and he wouldn't hear me on that.
But help me out with this, and then we'll let you sit down.
That's right.
Assuming that all he did was rule that the statute, that the breach of fiduciary duty claim is barred by the statute of limitations, the claim that the son breaches fiduciary duty to his dad while his dad was alive, all of those claims are barred by the statute of limitations. And it seemed like to me that's what you guys were basically discussing, and that's what the court
was. That's what I meant to discuss, yes, sir.
Right. And the court resolved that against you. Okay. Where does that leave your lawsuit? When your claim is he should be removed as executor because he breached his fiduciary duty to his dad while his dad was alive, and the court has ruled that is not a valid claim, where do you go from there with your request to remove the executor?
Pack up, go home. But that's not what he ruled.
Okay.
In my judgment.
You don't think he ruled on the statute of limitations concerning breach of fiduciary duty?
No, sir, because he went through the entire analysis about 6 months after non-suit. Now, this interesting history of this case is, as Ms. Lohr was pointing out, I filed suit to remove him in a non-suit for reasons I need not go into. Then I filed under the Uniform Power of Attorney Act. The beneficiaries would have, because the children have a direct claim to have the judge review attorney-in-fact decisions. The trial court said no, so I brought back my original claim. If you go through his analysis, since I didn't refile the suit to remove within 6 months of the non-suit, I'm timeline.
Well, I guess, and like I said, I'm going to let you sit down. I thought that's why it was important to read what he says before he does his analysis, because he says, plaintiffs urge the court to find if the defendant were removed, the successor fiduciary they seek to have appointed would not be time-barred in bringing claims against the defendant. And that's when he begins his analysis concerning 8.01, 229A, and he goes through all that.
I respectfully suggest that the court didn't address my position.
Okay, I understand you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.